Hello, people. This is the Outsider Podcast, and I'm your host for today, Alakat Tilola. So today we'll be having a medical professional coming to talk to us about female genital mutilation, FGM. So anything we need to know about that, it will be telling us. Female genital mutilation, that is circumcision of the female private parts. Yeah, it's kind of painful. Yeah, I know. I'm also crossing my legs together. That sounds so bad. Anyways, if you're telling us about it, how they can keep their personal hygiene, how it's coming prevented, and stuff like that. So stay tuned.
My name is Dr. Akinbi Eribago, a graduate of Bakwa. I work as a medical officer in an orthopedic hospital and an aspiring orthopedic surgeon. Orthopedic surgery is basically a section or part of surgery in general that involves bones, muscles, ligaments, tendons, and to an extent nerves. So surgery involving those, or, well, therapy involving, you know, repair of fractures, muscle issues, deformities, tears, and stuff. Okay. FGM is any surgical, okay, according to WHO anyway, any surgical modification of any surgical non-therapeutic modification of all or parts of the female genitalia, usually involving the external genitalia. So by external genitalia, we're talking about the clitoris, the prepuce of the clitoris, labia majora, labia minora, and vaginal orifice. So I just want to quickly explain that by non-therapeutic, it means that it's not done to cure any actual disease or illness or whatnot. So if you go to, a doctor because you have a cyst or there's a growth or something like that, and then the surgery done to remove those, it doesn't count as female genital mutilation. And just because I've said surgical doesn't mean that it involves hospital. Surgical just means, you know, use of a blade or cutting device. Anyway, so to explain that in layman terms now, I'll just be saying, FGM is any procedure involving cutting or removal of parts or all of the female private parts or female genitalia. I can say that, external genitalia.
Yes. Can someone die through it? Is there an health risk or anything like that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there is. But then I think the best way to go is to explain that most parts of our body is supplied by blood vessels and stuff. So there's the risk of bleeding. That's one health risk. Then most important, or the most prevalent or most common, would be risk of infection, right? So especially in most settings. In fact, from research that has been done recently on African countries especially, most African countries that observe female genital mutilation, or where female genital mutilation is practiced, it's usually done by non-medical personnel. So people who are most often uneducated, not versed. Yeah, well, we call them ritualists, but sometimes it's just village head, or the wife of the village head, or something like that. They always find one particular person with a particular age or characteristic that they give those duties to. So my point is, those people are usually not educated. They don't know the importance of infections, antibiotics, antiseptic procedures, and stuff. So usually, you would find that the blade that they use, the same blade that they're using for, say, party A, party B, party C, that same blade has not been washed, or is the same one that they use for girl D and E and stuff. So not just spreading infections from those girls, to the other ones, but then the fact that they're not even cleaning these things up and stuff also increase the risk of infection. And as you know, that area is also close to the anus and stuff like that. So if there's a cut, there's an exposed part of that part to, you know, different body fluids and stuff, is an increased risk of infection. Then other health risks, these are long-term risks now. You know that, you know, with every cut, there's a bit of healing, and people don't all heal the same way. Some people you find would have keloid or some sort of contracture or stuff like that. So sometimes, because of those small, minute cutting stuff that they do, it would affect maybe the vagina and stuff like that. So people like that, if they try to have sex later on in life, they would feel very serious amounts of pain and stuff, and then they're no longer able to enjoy their sex life and all that. And that's just one of a myriad of possible health conditions, really. But if one would die from female genital mutilation, it would usually be as a result of infection. And then there's also the psychological aspect. Let's not forget. You grew up without having part of the decision to completely mutilate your genitals and stuff.
But with the research, it shows that they're like 15-year-olds. They'll just pack all of them in a room and then cut it off.
Well, it depends on why they're doing it. Like, I think the age depends on why it's being done. So, well, for most countries, let me even call a few countries. You have Somalia, usually those in the east, Somalia, Egypt to the northeast. I think there's Niger, there's Mali, there's some countries that is really popular now, Ethiopia. So Ethiopia, Egypt, Somalia, they're all really close together in the northeast. In fact, they are bordering each other. Yeah. So you have Mali, you have Senegal, Nigeria to an extent as well.
Yeah,
so
some villages in Nigeria still.
Yeah. And if village close, New Babcock is a village really close to our school. I'll tell the story later.
Okay.
Anyway, so yeah, it's a very interesting story. Anyway, so the thing is, most of these places, they would usually circumcise or mutilate genitals of girls between the ages of 4 to 15. But some places have been known to do so even immediately after birth. Well, at the end of the day, it then borders on what the reasons are. So for most people, or for a lot of all these usually traditional reasons, like to preserve chastity, to ensure that the girl doesn't become promiscuous and stuff. So people with those kind of reasons, or people that believe that it's the next step before one enters womanhood and stuff, people with that are doing it for that kind of reason would usually...
Let us go on a quick break and we'll be back with more stories. And we are back.
So as I was saying, people who do it for that kind of reason usually do it in girls that are older. You get woman entering womanhood, preserving chest, they don't want her to be loose, and you know, a lot of funny reasons like that. But then for people who would do it because of religious background or something, or they believe they are observing tradition or other things like that, it would usually be in girls of younger ages. So that's just the demographic.
Okay. But as a medical personnel, do you guys practice circumcision on females?
No, at all, at all. No, in fact, we are trained almost, it's almost one lecture or the other every year to prevent it. Not just, what's it called, abstain from, you know, weird, bad, dangerous acts like that, but then to also actively prevent it in whatever community that we find ourselves in.
What if families ask you to help them do it, like after they give birth to their child and they're like, help us circumcise the girl?
Well, one could stop at just refusing, but then I see that kind of instance as an opportunity, in the sense that they've just asked you to do something that is bad. if they're asking you and they're doing being so bold about it, it's because they don't know it's bad and all that. So as a medical practitioner, you wouldn't just refuse. You wouldn't stop at just refusing. You take that opportunity to educate them as in a lot. You go a long way to counsel them. Counsel not just the immediate parents, but what's it called? Extended relatives who have a strong say in the what's it called? Decisions of the parents as well. So you try to counsel them, explain to them why it's bad and stuff. Sometimes even show them pictures, videos and stuff of complications of FGM. Most of them would not agree with you eventually, but you're not going to do it regardless.
Have you ever experienced any of the family members coming to meet you like, please help us cut?
Not exactly. But then I've been in a similar situation, but not exactly the same. So as I was mentioning, like I said, I schooled in Babcock, and then one of our postings involves going to villages around what's it called, Babcock. We just did a bit of research, collected data on some different issues. But one of those issues was female genital mutilation and the family's view on it. So I remember getting to this family. This is a village now, so most of the time they would not even go to hospital to deliver their children. Most would go to the friend of a nurse or one traditional birth attendant. Anyway, so the point is you want to try and be friendly, try and be open, non-condescending and stuff. So I asked this man what he thinks about female genital mutilation, and he said that his mother did it before him. That's why his mother was not sleeping around, unlike the girls nowadays. And the funny thing is, his wife also agreed, and they said that they're going to do that for all their daughters. I was embarrassed. I was shocked. Yeah, and then he was saying that he even complained that that's one of the problems with medical doctors of now. That we think that we know so much and all that, but that we're not able to prevent sexually transmitted diseases and whatnot, that this is a simple solution. Point is, me and the man argued for a long time, long. I don't think I changed his mind, but then that was probably one of my first instances where I would actually meet a family that, you know, would completely agree with me. Yeah, but the wife was not, as in the wife was also, circumcised as a child. And she seriously agreed with the guy, with her husband. That is because of that circumcision, that's why she was not sleeping around. And all that.
But the guy said prevention of STIs and STDs, but people that are circumcised, can they still get it?
Yes, they can, but their idea is that usually with those who, I think maybe I should also talk about that later. Usually with those who just cut off or who do what we call stage one FGM, where they just, I don't want to use the word just because it seems like I'm belittling it, who cut off the clitoris and stuff. The belief is that when you do that, you reduce the tendency of a young woman to have sexual urges and stuff like that, and that if you reduce that, then you reduce the likelihood of her having multiple sexual partners, because she probably wouldn't enjoy sex as much. So in reducing the number of sexual partners, you've reduced the number of STIs or the amount of STIs that she can get. Obviously the argument is flawed in 1 million ways, really. So many ways, but then that's the idea. So you usually have to try and explain to them that, well, you know, clitoridectomy won't necessarily reduce someone's sexual urges anyway, and you know, the injury and whatnot might even make susceptibility to most many STIs even more likely. Yeah, I was going to explain that FGM comes in stages. According to the WHO, World Health Organization, there are four levels of FGM. Yeah. So the first one is the one I just mentioned, where clitoridectomy, the removal of the clitoris and or the prepuce of the clitoris, right? Then there's step two, which involves removal of the clitoris, removal of the labia, mutilation or removal of the labia minora and or the labia majora. Then step three is the most severe, which is called infibulation, where the vaginal orifice, as the vaginal opening, is sort of reduced by stitching the labia minora and labia majora together. So it like creates a sort of pause string or something like that.
So they like sew it up?
Yeah, they sew them together, you get. So there's just one tiny opening left. And then their own belief is that it's the husband that will come and open it up and
cut off the thread. So how is she peeing?
Yeah, she was, well, I don't have any relative that has done that before, so I can't say. They usually leave a tiny opening, you get. They usually leave a tiny opening for pee and all that. But then I don't even need to explain that, especially with infibulation, because there's going to be a lot of residual pee that the woman can't clean off. Mm. Even during the infection, there will be a lot of backload of some of these stuff just stuck in there. That there's an increased risk of infection, you know, for the amount of hygiene that this kind of someone like that would be able to maintain would be so much less. Four is any other form of non-therapeutic modification of the external genitalia.
Wow, this is serious. So how can
that infibulation I mentioned is particularly common in parts of Somalia and parts of Nigeria, northern parts of Nigeria.
The sewing up.
Yeah, the sewing up thing. Then they also have this very popular knife that they use. The knowledge doesn't have any consequence, really. It's just for good knowledge. The knife is also used for cutting salt bags or something. Yeah, it's called a gishiri knife. They use it as it's used for salt. It's also used for circumcision. So you imagine the village head or something, salt trader by day, female genital mutilator by night. And the thing is, as the day passes, the word gets further and further into these remote areas and to people with internet. People are exposed to a lot of things. They can see the truth for themselves. So, well, it is better. Prevalence is reducing, but it's still a problem. It is still a problem for the girl child in Africa.
Yes, and that's so sad. But how can all this be prevented? Like, what do we need to do to make sure that people actually stop?
Well, the first step, that's primary prevention, would go to or involve increasing enlightenment. You know, now we know that in urban areas, at least, it's not as common a thing as it used to be. But then there are still areas where either due to lack of enlightenment or refusal to accept those levels of enlightenment anyway, people are still stubbornly adhering to ridiculous or unhealthy practices like this. So the first thing is to try to get the word out. Campaigns, government-sponsored campaigns, non-government-sponsored campaigns to ensure that people not just understand the physical health risks of female genital mutilation, but also the psychological aspect of it to the women involved, yeah? And then to also show the flaws in their arguments that you're not preventing STIs, you're not necessarily making a woman less promiscuous. If anything, you're just ensuring that, you know, she feels insecure about herself, health-wise, she's at risk of a lot of other more infections, and it's less likely to enjoy, you know, family life, you know.
With some of them, you will know. Some of them, we didn't know that they are circumcised. Won't they think that, okay, that's how their body is?
But then they would in the sense that you guess that most of them would have children, right?
Yeah.
They would have, so they know how children, the parts of children are. And then with urbanization and people moving around now, people are getting exposed to more people or from different parts of the country on a daily basis. Even, NYSC, for instance, where people are moved across different parts of Nigeria, and it's specifically made in such a way that they go to where they haven't been before, where they're not from.
Yes. Yet.
The point is, people are going to mix. So even before that now, you expect that even though the amount of education is not as much as we want it to be, people are still going to go to school, people are still going to, be taught about the reproductive system and stuff like that. Uncle lecturer, why is my own different, And then the other. And then with infibulation that I described, where there's an actual thread that is tying, there's nobody that's going to, I wouldn't want to generalize, but it's very unlikely that someone would see thread holding both parts of the vagina.
I think it's normal.
You can't be born with thread. And I was going to say that phase two of prevention, the first one is primary prevention, enlightening people, letting people know that it's not exactly to know the flaws in the argument, to understand the health risks and stuff. Phase two would be helping people with those complications already. You get, so there are a lot of people suffering from the after effects of FGM, right? So you want to reduce the health risks as much as you can, correct what you can surgically, what you can't, help with the psychological assessment, evaluate people who feel less of themselves or whatnot because of what has been done to them without their consent anyway. Try to maybe open clinics up that would specifically concentrate on female, genital hygiene, female genital health and stuff like that. Okay. So, like we've just mentioned, there are a few different steps, different levels. So with women who have, level one FGM, that's where the clitoris or the prepuce or both of them have been removed. There isn't really much, the vaginal orifice and the vagina itself are not really affected as such. So the only danger would then be, if, for instance, the clitoris was removed and the prepuce wasn't, where they would have to ensure that there's nothing that is just staying in there, or try to ensure that there's no buildup of fluids or any collection that would cause infections and stuff. And also, they notice anything like an infection or whatnot, always be ready to come to the hospital. With phase two, where it's the labia minora majora that have been removed, the issues with that would be smearing usually of the underwear with discharge, especially if copious. There would sometimes be, there would always be issues with the way the body would handle discharge and stuff, especially if it's both the labia minora and majora that have been removed. So in instances like that, especially when it's really bad, you might have to recommend use of protective pads and stuff like that. Sometimes also, with infections, abscess collection, scars and stuff, the usual advice would be anything beyond that, that is beginning to go into the range of an infection, always come to the hospital, let the doctor see. And then with the last phase, which is the infibulation, where everything is sewn together, the labia minora and majora are sewn together. The problem with that, as you can understand, is usually they leave a small inadequate hole for both urine and menstruum and whatnot to come up, which is very difficult. You get, so in that kind of instance, the first step to aiding hygiene would be releasing the infibulation in the first place to ensure that the excreted or removed properly. So that would usually be what would be done. Yeah. But then these things are not really possible without like proper counseling and stuff, explaining what is normal. Like you said, how would they know if it's normal? So explaining what is normal, letting them understand what isn't normal, you know, how to care for themselves and stuff like that.
All right, so Dr. Eri, telling us about female genital mutilation, and this is in support of the International Women's Day. This is me saying, I choose to challenge female genital mutilation in Nigeria and in every other part of the world that is doing it. So thank you very much for listening to this episode. We'll meet again. Bye.